Hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7 and 103.9 on the air here. Once again, coming at you live from the center of the universe. That's Clear Creek County, Colorado, and the Rabbit Hole. Second half of the Writer's Talk. We had special edition today. We get to have a couple authors, and in the studio with me is Laurel McArg. And Laurel, just want to test that microphone and say hey to our audience here.
Hey to your audience. I also want to thank you and KYGT for what you do with getting out communications about emergencies in the local area, because my husband's the emergency manager for Lake County, and I know how much we would appreciate something like that.
Well, you know, and that's thank you for saying that, because it is such a valuable community resource when you have that.
Right.
You know, it could do the reverse 911, you know, all that stuff. That you're absolutely right. Thank you for bringing that up.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for your community service.
Yeah, it's great here. So, but and we're going to talk about your works and so forth, but I do want to thank Dex is going to be sponsoring our this hour here. So I want to Dex, and if you need any information, you can call 1-800 call Dex or DexKnows.com. So thanks, Dex, for sponsoring, and all of our supporters, because it's community radio and nonprofit, and without our supporters, and you know, and I brought the last hour, I sponsored that, and we have many of our businesses around the community that jump in here and help support that. Otherwise, we wouldn't be on the air.
Thank you, Dex and community.
There you go. So, but author Laurel McArg is an award-winning author, and she's a 1983 graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point.
Yes.
And she was raised in Braintree, Massachusetts, but somehow found her way to the breathtaking elevation of Leadville. I think it's like the highest city in the...
It is, and is literally breathtaking. 10,200 feet elevation is where we live.
So, literally and figuratively.
Yes. Yes.
Because, you know, I used to, and I go through there a couple of times a year and have lunch up there. And, you know, you got the collegiate peaks heading down the road there.
Right. And not everyone can live there. It's it's a challenging place to live, for sure.
It's cold. So, toughen up here, too, you know. So, but, yeah, she lives in Leadville, Colorado, and, you know, 10,000 feet plus, where she has taught and currently lives with her husband and ranger, the German Shepherd.
He's a good boy.
A little shout out there to Ranger.
He's probably listening right now. He's quite the mummy's boy.
Oh, good. Okay, so woof, we'll just woof. We were just talking about wolves in the last hour here, so woof out to, you know, we do a shout out to your husband and a woof out to Ranger.
Thank you.
All right. And she recently established the Leadville Literary League, a nonprofit organization with a mission to promote local literary endeavors in the arts, and is working on her seventh publication. Fascinating stuff, you know, and, you know, that's one of my goals, too, is to promote reading.
Yes, yes.
And you're doing
in the arts, yes. Mm-hmm. The little bit of a story behind that, a friend of mine is the president of the Tabor Opera House Preservation Foundation, and she asked what I might do to help raise funds for the Tabor. It's in late 1800s opera house. You might be aware of it. And it needs quite a bit of work. And I thought, one of my goals is to write and produce in many, many genres. And the idea of the Calendar Girls movie back in 2003 just struck me. And I thought, oh, I wonder if I could get away with doing something like that in Leadville. And I put out an advertisement, and I had way more than 12 women ages 50 and over, because that was my requirement. I'm looking for antique women. More than 12 women rose to the challenge, and we have been having a blast creating that calendar. It's going to be truly beautiful.
Oh, that is fun. And I saw on your website you had a little fun with the eclipse.
Yes, I did. And that was pretty funny, too. The day before the eclipse, a friend of mine asked if we were doing an eclipse photo shoot for the calendar. And I just was stunned that I hadn't even thought of it. And so Elise Sunday, who is our photographer, she also owns Fire on the Mountain. It's a paint-your-own pottery shop. I contacted her and I said, what do you think about doing an eclipse photo shoot? And she loved the idea. And I tried a little bit to get in touch with some people who might want to do it. And basically, I decided when I got no responses, I decided really I was the one who wanted to do it. So we went way up toward Mosquito Pass. Mm-hmm. And let's just say I communed with the eclipse. And it was a beautiful photo shoot.
Oh, it is fantastic. So I hope people check it out on your website there, because it, and it was so, it is beautiful. It is so natural that there, and to be one in part, you know, with that experience of nature.
Yes, and with my military background and being in uniform for so many years, I was graduated from West Point in 1983, 9 years active duty and three years in the reserves, and in uniform most of the time. And to be completely out of uniform
I like the way you
on the day
that.
Of the eclipse was magical. It was truly magical.
So what got you into writing?
Well, I was always a storyteller in my family. I was the one, I'm the fourth of five girls. I'm the one who'd come downstairs and want to share my dreams, and my parents would roll their eyes and sometimes tolerate my stories. And then as I grew, I loved telling stories about whatever it is I happened to be doing. So I journaled my whole time in high school. I hated high school years. I was miserable. Mm-hmm. And I used my journals for basically like a private shrink. Mm-hmm. And I just would express myself in them. And friends of mine would tell me, you know, you ought to write down some of these stories. And I always thought that I would write. I remember my fifth grade English teacher. She was incredible. And she was a hippie. She would bring us out to the playground and have us lay down on the grass and peer through the grass blades and then write a poem about it, or lay on our back and have the ants crawl over us and look up at the sky and write a poem about it. So I still have my fifth grade poetry book that I created that year, and she really made me believe in myself as a writer and a poet. So after all my army years and my teaching years, I came into possession of a shoebox full of letters from my dad from World War II that he had written home to his parents before he even met my mom. Mm-hmm. And this was while my dad was still alive. And when I started looking through those letters, I knew I needed to write. And I knew I needed to do something with those letters. I'm still doing something with those letters. That book is not yet completed. But in the process of making the decision to stop paid employment and become an author, I started writing stories, and I started a writing group. I always had a writing group at the high school with the high school students I taught. And then when I stopped teaching, I started an adult writing group. And a new girl came into the group, Stephanie Sorensen. She writes under the name of. She came into my group and said, "Who's going to do NaNoWriMo with me this year?" And none of us knew what NaNoWriMo was. It's National Novel Writing Month. And it's the month of November. It's a personal challenge to write 50,000 words in 30 days. And so when she explained it to us, we all just thought she was crazy. And then on October 30th, I started thinking about it, and I knew she was going to do it. And then October 31st, I knew that I had to accept the challenge and try to write 50,000 words. Well, then I thought, well, what novel am I going to write? And I remembered that I had journaled my whole first year of teaching English, seventh grade English, in a school that ultimately ended up closing. So I had a year's worth of actual stuff and dialogue and crazy incidents that happened that year, and I decided I would write a book about that. And, you know, since I had threatened my seventh grade students that year that I would someday write about them, which excited them, and they all wanted to be in it. "Oh, Miss, oh, Miss, oh, Miss, can I be in it?" I named the novel Miss, because that's what I was always called. And that's my first novel, just based on loosely fictionalized my first year experience.
I'm excited. I want to read this, because at one time I had two halves of my teaching career, and the first half was in middle school.
So, and, you know.
Oh yeah, and I had a dear friend, Lori, and we were out one time, you know, because my joke was always like, just, you know, get through. Thursday was always the toughest day, because it just built up. Friday just seemed to go like, yeah, okay, get through it. And I said, just get through Thursday, get to Friday, you know, happy hours, you know, right after, and we'll go there. So we were all out this one time, and she was just going on, and she said, "You're sad, you're mad, you're glad, you're bad." And I said, if I ever write a a book about teaching
middle
school.
That'll be the title.
That'll be the title.
That's a great title.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you wanted me to read anything.
Oh, yeah.
But
please do. Yeah.
So there was this one day, and it was early in the year. And again, here I was, a resigned Army major, thinking that teaching seventh grade English, I could just do with my hands tied behind my back.
Yeah.
Oh, these kids cleaned my clock. Anyway, after one particular quiz, which I thought was simple, and they all thought was written in Swahili, I was a little upset. So here we go. Wanting to kick and scream and throw herself down on the floor, Maggie instead pulled out one of her Dick and Jane books. It was time to talk more about sentence structure, one of the traits, and she figured the books showing scenes of the perfect white family with the perfect little dog in the perfect little white picket fence neighborhood would at least be entertaining. Perfect little white students were the minority at North, and even those students would be surprised to see the Father Knows Best storyline Maggie would present to them. These are the books my aunts learned to read with in the first grade, she said. I know that was a long time ago, but the Dick and Jane stories are classics, and some of you may even have seen the movie Fun with Dick and Jane. Dick, several of her students giggled. Yeah, try to get over the name. It used to be a pretty common name for Richard, she said, trying to downplay their reaction. I want you to listen to the sentences and think about how short and simple they are. My expectation for your writing this year is for your sentences to be more advanced than what I'll read in this book and what I've been reading in the notes you continue to pass to one another. There were snickers throughout the class. This chapter is called Big and Little. Maggie read the first page. Come and see. See Father and Mother. Father is big. Mother is little. She showed her students the illustrations of Mom and Dad, then turned the page. Look, Father, Dick is big.
I'm imagining middle school minds now just rolling with this here. You got them on the floor rolling.
Yes.
Oh, that's hysterical.
Yes, it goes on. It goes on. I could stop there. But
yeah, you get the point, though.
Get the point, though, yes. Yeah. And they were literally rolling on the floor.
Yeah.
And I lost it. I just chalked that lesson up to letting them know that teachers could have some fun too. What else could I do?
And then,
I hadn't previewed it. I hadn't previewed the pages to come. And as soon as I said the words, I thought, oh boy.
Yeah, you know, who's my audience here? And that's great because you don't know that until you get in there.
Right.
And of course, they're all going through that stage now, adolescent stage and puberty and so forth. But everything has sexual connotations, the whole thing. And of course, you know, and it's like, okay.
We had a lot of fun in staff meetings for probably the next month, as some of my teacher peers would bring up to me things that the kids would say after that lesson.
Yeah. That's one of the regrets I have is that I never really wrote down. I should have, because there were so many classic moments, both with the middle school and even high school, but particularly the freshmen. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I taught 10th grade for 4 years and then went up to the college. Yeah.
Oh, it was fun stuff there. So you get there. Do you ever, when you're writing, this is something I kind of struggle with, and it's the concept of writer's block.
Oh, writer's block. Right. Pshaw. I say pshaw to writer's block. And here's why. You may be blocked on what your next character will say. You may be blocked about what the next scene should have in it. But to be completely blocked as a writer, I just think that's an excuse for laziness, because I think if you really want to write, you can write about anything. I mean, look at your finger. Take a look at your finger and write a story about where that finger has been.
Okay, well, no.
that will unblock you. But really, just you could look at the poster that you have here, this incredible building that we're in right now.
Yeah.
Try to imagine who spent time here before. Go outside, smell the air. I mean, you don't necessarily have to write about what your goal is for the day, but you can still write.
Yeah, I like that. And because one of the individuals that I, Stephen Pressfield, I don't know if you ever
heard. Oh, yes, him. Yes. Do the work.
Yeah.
His books are wonderful. Mm-hmm. I read a couple of his. Do the Work is the name of one of them, right?
Mm-hmm. And War of Art.
War of Art, yeah.
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 And
great
just
books.
And it's just like you said about writer's block and laziness and so forth. Yeah. And I like the way you put it, though, because there's writer's block and there's writer's block. because I was struggling, and I'm working on my next novel, and I had written, you know, a couple of pages on this one character, and it was just like I hit a wall, and I'm like, and a few days ago, it finally hit me that I had him in the wrong place.
Uh-huh.
And so I changed the scene completely, moved him out of the original and put him, you know, in this other, and it just started to flow.
Nice, nice. Yes. It's funny. Sometimes during my writing groups, we'll do quick writing prompts. And one particular one, and this is when I was in high school, I had one student pick a noun, one student pick, you know, pick a verb, pick a place, pick a person. And so it was an old lady, and the noun was orichalcum, which I had never heard of. Mm-hmm. And it's a special, magical kind of metal. And old lady, orichalcum in the garage. And we wrote a scene about it, and I ended up using that scene, tweaking it a bit for my overleader, my bad guy character in my novel Water White. The idea of orichalcum being this magical metal turned into something that I could actually use. So sometimes, and this is what I do now, if you're looking for a quick little prompt, try to think of how you might use that prompt, which could be totally out of context for what you're working on. Mm-hmm. Try to use that in whatever big project you're working on and see if it might fit somewhere at some point. Mm. I had no idea at the time that I wrote it that it would fit into my book so well.
What do you think happens then when that begins to happen, that process, in terms of thinking like synapses in the brain and so forth? Because my thinking is that we get ourselves so locked into a box.
Yes, and I think some of us are planners and some of us are pantsers. And I think, if you're familiar with the terms, planners have quite an outline for their writing. Pantsers, I've been a pantser most of my life.
Right.
Things just flow out of me and I go with it. I think if we're too much in a box, it can stifle you. So I'll often suggest write a scene that's in the future in your story or in your dialogue. Write somewhere in the middle. You don't have to start at the beginning. You don't have to necessarily know for sure where it's going to end, although it certainly helps you get there. But write a scene that could be completely out of context, and you might be surprised where it might fit in sometime in the future.
Yeah, that's it. You know, and I've had last several weeks that we've talked about that, and I don't think we can talk about it enough, the difference between a planner and a pantser. You know, and Annalisa Parent was on with me about 4 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It called, and she's written a work on that whole thing, storytelling, you know, from the pantser thing.
Right.
And I had said about, because that's, I'm like you, I'm a pantser. And I also put it in context of chaos theory.
Okay.
That, you know, the universe was chaos, but, you know, it began to organize. So there's always organization. So you can have stuff all over the place. Even you write a scene like you're describing there, Laurel, about, you know, maybe not even context of the story. Maybe later that might just be an aspect of it.
An aspect of it or something for a completely different book. Mm-hmm. I totally pantsed Water White. Book one of the Water White series. It started with a dream on my mom's 86th birthday. Literally, I woke up with this crazy dream, and I shared it with a friend, Carol Bellhouse, who's another very prolific author from Leadville. And the dream was, in a nutshell, of me running away from bad guys, having to fly over a large body of water, starting to fall, and having a flying frog rescue me and get me to the other side. So I shared this portion of the dream with her, and she said, oh my goodness, you have to write a story about that. And I hadn't considered really writing fantasy adventure, because most of my writing has been in the nonfiction or loosely fictionalized nonfiction. But the idea just made my head explode, and I started writing. And so it's not me, but it's a 14-year-old girl who has to save the world from an encroaching body of stinking ooze. And this flying frog, I had to make him French, even though Carol said I couldn't, but I had to make him French, saves her and becomes her mentor in a way. And they're talking animals, and my walking buddy, John Stewart, pointed out this beautiful profile of an old man halfway down Mount Massive. And so Old Man Massive is a mountain spirit in my story. Mm. And almost every day I would see something or meet a child and ask them what superpower they'd have if they could choose. And it just unfolded. One young boy, his name is Bridger, who struggled with coming up with a superpower. He was only about 5. And he told me, I would build things. Mm-hmm. And I asked permission of his parents to both use his name and his superpower. And he became, and is going to become in the future books too, quite a character in the story.
Oh, wow.
And I never would have thought of building things as a superpower.
Yeah. And I love the name, Bridger.
Bridger. Bridge. Was perfect.
It's like building and, you know, connecting and everything too.
Right.
So just the unconscious connection you make.
Yeah.
You know.
So that was 13 months from dream to publication.
Wow.
And I'm really happy with it and excited about it. And once I finished it, it's also great for classrooms too, because I didn't dumb down my vocabulary, and I included in the back of it a synonym glossary.
Okay.
For the big words I use.
Yay.
And some discussion questions. But I knew that at the end of book one, the story continued, and we needed to find out where Celeste was. And in book two, we're going to spend quite some time with Odin, who is a god of the sky. And while I was at West Point, cadets would pray to Odin for rain so that we could get out of parade practice. So I used Odin in book one. And I thought, okay, this is a story about the water and there's something in the water. And so I tried to find a water god that wasn't a boring one like Poseidon, Neptune, you know, the ones that we all know. And I found this water god called Komogwe. He's an Inuit water god, and he's also called the Copper Maker, which is crazy because there's something to do with copper in book one that I didn't even foresee as being something in book two.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So very excited about book two. But since I pantsed book one, if you do a series, you really then have to plan. So book two is planned as much as I can plan. I know the number of chapters, and I've written down one or two sentences for each chapter, mm-hmm. so I know where it's going.
Okay.
Because we basically have 3 different storylines that we're following in book two.
Wonderful. And this is like a adolescent, young adult,
but mm-hmm. Mature individuals are enjoying it as well.
oh, sure, absolutely. You know, because I have several good friends who are writing in that level, you know, genre. The idea of bringing in the fantasy and
so
the
much
magical
fun.
Realism.
Oh, you know. My goodness. Mm-hmm. Magical realism. It's just, it's been a blast. Because you can dream. I have an enormous, multicolored, swirling jaguar who came from a dream.
Okay.
I have several other scenes that came from dreams that I had while I was working on the story.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, it's fantastic. So all right, and so you got water. So while we're talking about, I'm going to go ahead and do and if you want to flip through and find a selection here, because since we're talking about, let's do a reading from there, like you did from Miss. But while you're kind of flipping through to decide which one you would like to do, I just want to remind our listening audience that this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9 on the air here in the center of the universe, and that's Clear Creek County, Colorado, and visiting here with Laurel McGarg, also known as Leadville Laurel, I should say, and having a fantastic conversation. This is The Rabbit Hole and Writer's Talk. Want to thank Dex once again for sponsoring this hour here. So, I asked, Water White is the name of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it's water, WIGHT, not the color. There's a funny story to go behind the title as well.
Right. So white as in rhymes with light or is spelled like
it's
light.
Spelled, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
and
not the color.
Do you know what a white is?
It's some type of creature.
Yes, it is an obsolete noun meaning a human being, a supernatural being as a witch or a sprite, any living being or a creature. So you really don't know what the water white is. That's there's a bit of mystery in there.
Okay. Oh, that adds to the fun.
Yeah. So let's see. Celeste, my hero, has just left a children's home. There has been an event that has cracked the world open, and things are not as they were before, and no one wants to talk about the event or what's happened in the children's home. She decides she needs to run away because she wants answers, and no one will go with her. So, with a lingering memory of her father's lesson in mind, her father had given her a lesson in how to read a compass, she grew anxious to leave the filthy place. At least the cats hadn't touched her food. She devoured one mushy apple while reading the bizarre poem again. She gathered her things and stepped outside. If only the cats were there, she might talk to them again, or determine she must have been hallucinating. Talking cats were things for fairy tales, and the world outside looked like no fairyland she'd ever read about. The sky was a cloudless blue, which emphasized the devastation all around her. While running through the town in the dark, she hadn't noticed the crumpled buildings and rutted streets, the fallen trees and dead grass, the overall desolate atmosphere. Holding the compass in her hand, she turned until the red arrow pointed north, the direction of the children's home. She turned around to face the south. Her home was gone. Why would someone tell her to head south, and where was the danger? She had no idea what finding the springs meant, or why her nose would be involved in finding them. And singing? Who sang anymore? As for eeny, meeny, miny, and moe, she could make no sense of that whatsoever. She shook her head, mystified. Although the sun shone brightly, the hairs on the back of Celeste's neck prickled. A surge of energy motivated her to move away from the house, and she headed south, her pace quickening with her growing feeling she wasn't safe. Her brisk walk became a jog, and then an all-out run when she looked over her shoulder and saw in the distance a small pack of what looked like wild dogs fighting. Celeste heard one faint, gruff voice from the direction of the pack. The animals stopped their commotion and turned in her direction. "Food," she heard, and ran like she never had before.
Wow. I liked it. You know, you start right off, and this is early in the novel. So she's a...
She's an orphan.
An orphan. I was going to say a lost little girl, but yes. Not lost. Yeah. Not in the... But that she doesn't have a family or whatever.
Right.
And her circumstances, the children's home is not very desirable.
Right.
And so she's now... heading out on a journey.
Heading out, searching for answers. She grabbed some mushy apples from the countertop and left with no real plan in mind. Mm-hmm. And her first night, she sleeps in a very desolate, dirty house where there were cats who lulled her to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And they were gone in the morning. And so she's not really sure if she believes what happened.
Yeah.
But she knows she's in danger.
She's in danger.
And there was a poem left in her journal
that
said she needed to head south.
Okay.
South was where she'd find her home.
And she can understand the dogs, the wild packs. I mean,
yes.
They said food.
Yes.
She understands
yes.
the...
Yep. She can. Yes, she can hear them.
Was Ranger your model in this, by the way?
He was. Of course he was. Had to have Ranger. Yeah, actually, many of my nieces and nephews have children, and I used their names and their superpowers as little loose guides for who I could have in the story.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much fun, you know, with the story there. And so it just kind of starts to come up. Yeah. I'm intrigued by your statement that you could be a pantser, but if you do a series, then that kind of starts to force you into, more of a planner sort of thing there.
Right. You have to remember who your characters are and what they've done and what their motivations are.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is going to be a trilogy. So
okay.
I pretty much need to know where it's going. So
yeah.
I know where book two is going to end and I know where book three will end.
Mm-hmm.
The fun about being a pantser though is even though I've planned very loosely the outline, as I'm writing the chapter and listening for the dialogue, that all just comes out. My characters decide what they're going to do and what they're going to say. And so every chapter ends up being a surprise in a way to me. And in some instances, I'll end at a place that will have me tweak future chapters because of where I've ended.
Do you, and I've had authors say this, like these characters are like in your head and they wanted... in the unconscious, if you will.
Yes.
And are just saying, I need to be expressed. And so you become the medium you know,
like
afford
that. I like that idea. Having many characters in a book like this, which I've never really done before, other than in Miss, and those were real students I used. Mm-hmm. Having the many characters, the challenge is to make them unique, to make them sound different, to give them different motivations and have them have their own little quirks or expectations.
And that's where I think you get into, now when I say you, I mean in the generic sense of you, the author. Once you start getting into the development of the character, it almost becomes like a Jungian exercise that you start to identify this character, or they start taking on like an archetype. Mm-hmm. There is this certain aspects of them, and there are, of course, an infinite amount of archetypes.
Right, right.
But they're universal themes that people from all over can identify with, you know, even if you're not an American and you don't speak English, you understand the principle of
fear, being an orphan. Empathy, power, love, lust, all those things. Mm-hmm. Yes. And evidently it all comes from the author and the universe. I'm going to say the universe too.
Sure.
Because if I think of one of my novels, should we go into my...
absolutely. I'm just fascinated by because you're such a your work is just so I want to say not disparate, but you just don't
write one
thing.
It exactly, and that's I think that makes me a little different. Maybe I remember one of my friends telling me you should be the education author. I had written Miss, which is based on teaching, and it's a seventh grade classroom, and it deals with teacher issues. I then did Water White, and that can be used. I would love for teachers to use that as for many different reasons in their classroom. I love haiku, so I did a couple of haiku. You could call them gift journals. My Haikus Can Amuse is a gift journal, and then made one for the classroom with just 90 haiku starters. I start the haiku and you finish it.
And haiku is Japanese.
Haiku is a Japanese three-line poem with 17 syllables, five syllables in the first line, seven in the second, five in the third.
Right.
So that was all fun. But when I heard you should be the education author, I stomped my foot and I said, no, I am going to write in as many genres as possible while I can still see the daisies. So... that's one of my goals, and I guess that makes me different. I like the challenge of trying to do something beyond my comfort zone. I feel very comfortable writing blog posts. I look for the humor in everyday situations, and if you go to leadvillelaurel.com, that's where I put all my blog posts, and it could be anything from waking up in the morning with hair in my mouth and cutting it all off and talking about that, or cleaning up my 25-year-old son's apartment and finding scary things under the fruit bin, whatever it happens to be. I'll write about that. So the goal to write in many different genres is challenging, and I would challenge anybody to try to write something outside their comfort zone. So back to my friend Stephanie, who suggested the NaNoWriMo, the 30-day challenge for 50,000 words.
Right.
She then last year said, "How about a 3-day novel contest?" There's a Canadian 3-day novel contest on Labor Day weekend every year, and you sign up for it. I think if you sign up early, it's $35, something like that. And the goal is from midnight Friday of Labor Day weekend to midnight Monday of Labor Day weekend, you write a novel.
You're going to labor for at your keyboard or whatever. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So again, I said, you're crazy.
But you're in.
But I want to do it. I'm in.
I knew it. There we go.
I'm in.
Awesome.
So this was months before the actual contest. I talked with my husband and asked if there was any way he could leave the house for a week. He has family in California, so he said, why don't I go visit my father and my brother that weekend? And I said, that would be wonderful. And that way, my crazy friend could come to my house, and for 3 days straight, the two of us could see what we could knock out. So from months before this, probably almost 3 months before that, I had in mind that I would do something completely different. I have never written in second-person perspective before, and I wanted to try that. And I thought, oh, why don't I do something light and fun? And one day, on a walk with my buddy again, John Stewart, he picked up a little plastic toy that he saw on the street, and I took it from him. It was a little sword, and I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if we did a story about someone who had, like, lucky charm kind of thing, and lucky things would happen to him, but silly lucky things, like nothing really superpowerish, but just funny things. And I imagined the sword becoming a real big plastic sword. I imagined a candy wrapper that he might pick up being filled with a piece of candy, something like that. Well, my very loose outline for that silly little story quickly morphed when I started writing. And I'll just say there was probably a very lustful spirit in my house. And the idea of writing in the second-person perspective brought to mind Rod Serling from the Twilight Zone series, which I loved as a child.
Right.
And so, you know, he would start every episode with something like, imagine, if you will, there's a dark street you're walking down. There's a light at the end of the street, a lone cafe. You know you shouldn't go in, but you do. So that spirit infested my psyche. And my lucky boy found a rabbit's foot. So I did a little research on rabbit's feet and the luck that goes behind that. And I decided he would have a Friday the 13th birthday. And so all these dark elements infested my brain while I started writing. And this turned out to be, the way I explain it, is Grimm's fairy tales meets the Twilight Zone meets teenage boy fantasy, heavy on the teenage boy fantasy. And so while I was in one room writing this and laughing my butt off every time my character would say something that was very teenage boyish, my other friend who was writing in the other room, Stephanie, she was writing something very serious and dark, and she was trying not to cry, and she's hearing me giggling in the other room. It was an amazing weekend, really. And this flowed out of me. This was totally pantsed because it flowed out of me, and it's very naughty. It's a naughty adult fairy tale.
Okay.
Not for children.
Okay.
But I had a blast writing it.
Okay. And what's the...
Oh, the name of it is The Hare, H-A-R-E.
Okay.
Raising Truth.
Raising Truth.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And so it's a dark fantasy.
Dark adult fantasy.
But young, with humor?
With humor. I would call it dark humor.
Okay.
With a twist in the end, with definitely a grim ending.
Yeah, you know, grim as in G with one M, not two, but the
both.
Brothers.
Yeah. My husband claims it's the best thing I've written. And I've had people ask me how on earth I got into the mind of a, shall we say, randy teenage boy's head. And I shrug and I say, well, I've raised two sons and army.
Yeah.
I've been around a few.
Yeah, and you taught high school.
And I taught high school.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's it. You know, when you're reading from Miss earlier there, you know, with the middle schoolers, you know, that, you know, you pick up, and if you would have had that same exercise with juniors in high school, you might have had a few chuckles and like, and then let's move past it. But with, you know, when they're 13, is like, boom, here.
Yeah.
So where the brain development, the social development, everything for the kids. And so, you know, you get the randy teenager and it's like, well, I remember someone like that about 50 years ago and he's sitting here on the microphone.
I don't like. Oh, yeah. I think you should read this tonight.
I probably will. You know,
sit down.
Well, I'm going to the Bronco game, but then after the game, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, well, tomorrow I'll get launch into it. Oh my God, I'm so looking forward to it. So when you're right, I'm just so intrigued by you know, your wide range. As you say, you're not writing in one genre and one level, and you know, you got nonfiction and fiction, and you know, you have that creative strength. Kryptonite. Was there a kryptonite that it's in you that is like
my writer's kryptonite?
Yeah.
Oh, I have to confess. Social media. I'll just say it. Social media is my writing kryptonite.
Why?
Because it draws me in, and part of I've made excuses in the past that being on Facebook, being on Twitter, being on all these places helps build my audience, helps engage with my audience. I'm writing little tweets and things. The bottom line, though, is that I can spend a whole day easily engaging with my audience and tweeting and not get anything done on a big project. So really, the fact that I wrote The Hair-Raising Truth in 36 hours, I completely shut everything off.
Mm-hmm.
I sat my butt in the chair and I did the work, like Stephen Pressfield says. I set my timer for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not let myself out of my seat for an hour. When the timer went off, I would either reset it for another hour because I was on a roll, or I would stand up and stretch, take the dog for a quick walk around the block. And actually doing something like that, I would highly recommend if you're in a writing binge, is to definitely get up every once in a while, stretch every once in a while, go outside, get some fresh air. Mm-hmm. Even sometimes just walking around the block with the dog will give you an idea. Or if you don't have a dog, just walk around the block. It will open something up. It might make a connection in your brain. It'll definitely give your brain more oxygen,
uh-huh.
which in Leadville you need.
Yeah.
So social media, yes, I need to stay away from that. It's addictive for me.
Yeah.
I'll just say it. It's addictive for many people.
Yeah, that's it. And thank you for saying that, because that was something I struggled with. I wouldn't even have a Facebook page unless I had written my book.
Right, yeah.
And I really assiduously work hard to keep my Facebook page dedicated to my book and this show. And so I put up, you know, like the announcements and that sort of, you know, there. And other events that might be related to the reading, publishing, that sort of stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am not going to put on the fact that, okay, I went to the Bronco game, here's a picture, that sort of stuff there with my take on the political. Okay, I write the paper for that.
Talk about a rabbit hole.
Yeah, and because it is, because you become so addicted, you get so engrossed, because if someone responds to you and, you know, in some way, then you feel compelled.
Yes, you know? there's a bit of guilt, mm-hmm. too, that goes along with it. If you have a following and you have people who are enjoying your posts, and then you feel somewhat obligated to respond, to follow them, and then that's mm-hmm. all you're doing is socializing.
Yes, and that becomes like a form of, it's avoidance, and that's what Pressfield put it. I don't think he used the word avoidance there.
Something like that, though.
You just cut yourself off at the knees there.
Right.
Resistance.
Yeah.
It's a form of resistance. So, okay, I'm afraid to get into this novel or into this here. So I'm gonna tweet
something, or I'm going to clean my closet.
Yeah.
Or go through my spice rack.
Right.
There are many things that you can do to get you sidetracked. And sometimes you need to clean your closet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I liked when you said also about getting and going out for the walk sort of thing there. Mm-hmm. But I would add to that I think an element is to not to lose your energy in that work.
Right.
So don't go out there and start trimming the hedges.
Right. Just make it a quick breather.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of exorcise the negative things that are just building up. You know, we do in the body and the mind, and then that allows fertile ground. That's what I think I did when I mentioned, you know, like how I basically threw out the beginning of that whole chapter there.
Yeah,
and started
over.
And once I did, I was back in my element.
Yeah, good. And talking about throwing out chapters, you really, and I'm talking to authors here and writers, you really need to have other people read your work.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you might think is brilliant, and of course I think everything I write is brilliant, but what you might think is brilliant or needs to be in there, another person might find distracting or unnecessary or overdone or not embellished enough. And you'll get that kind of feedback from someone like that. So if you're in a writer's group or a reader's group, if you have beta readers, I would say definitely use them before you hit the publish button. There's so much out there that is unedited and unreadable, frankly.
Right. And speaking of editing then, so do you have an editor? Do you edit your own stuff? And if so, if you work with someone, does that person help you in the developmental, that is through the writing process, or is it more substantive after? What's your...
I have several different people who do different things.
Okay.
My two writer friends, Stephanie Sorensen and Carol Bellhouse, they help me with developmental things. They'll also pick up little things, little edits. I don't ask them to do that, but they'll pick up on the developmental things. They'll say, all right, you needed this whole chapter needs to go, or the first half of this chapter needs to go. You need to start it here. Or what is this person's motivation? I don't get it. Or this person isn't really likable. Do you mean for them to come across this way?
Mm-hmm.
So they'll give me that kind of really invaluable feedback, which you need if you want people to, if you want to put out a good product. And then as far as editing your own stuff, as a past English teacher, I think I can edit my own stuff, and I will read through, and I will find mistakes here and there all over the place, and then I will send it to a professional, and I will pay a professional for just that, those types of things, those ofs instead of ifs, homonyms that you don't catch, missing words that you don't catch. Because when you read your own writing, you know what you've written and you fill in the blanks and you don't see the errors.
Well, yeah.
You've got to pay somebody or give it to someone you know who is an eagle eye for doing that kind of thing.
You know, and a classic word for me, two words. They're the identical except for one letter. Mediate and meditate.
Yes.
You mean one or the other,
right.
And either you put the T in or you don't put the T in.
Yes, and there were so many like that. So many like that. Pay for the polish.
Yeah.
Please pay for the polish.
Absolutely. Yeah. No question about it there. And, you know, because that's something, you know, that some people, you know, I like to write. I had written my whole work. I had the entire manuscript done before I moved it over to editing. And fortunately, it just worked out beautifully that, you know, with my editor, Melanie, you know, one thing led to another and connected. And after some couple conversations with her, she understood what I was trying to do because it's a very complex work, you know, in terms of the time tenses, everything. And once she did, she said, okay, I get it. And we're going to need to do some rearranging. I said, that's fine. And she did a magnificent job with that. So when I started on the sort of the sequel, because I'm going to do a trilogy, but I'm not doing it in the traditional trilogic way.
Right.
And so I, you know, just called her and said, okay, here's what my thought, blah, 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 like this. And she said, oh my God, yeah, there's stuff here. And then she just hit me with a lot of questions.
Yes.
Which,
yes,
then,
both my my writer friends will do that too. They'll ask me questions that will get me thinking and some of the questions I never would have come up with myself. Oh, and what they'll find in my writing is, are things that I repeat, words that I'll use over and over and over again that I won't even know I'm using, phrases that I'll use redundantly. I need to type up that list because I basically wrote down all over the manuscript. I would write down, I would circle, I would say, look up this. And of course, you know, once you go back and you do a global search on the word suddenly, say, or any other thing that you overuse, and you find that there are 652 times that you've used the word that, and you don't need that many that's.
You know, on that point, that construction always that. Like we're just, you know, so as we that our way through, you know, when is it requisite and when can you do without it? You know, that sort of thing there.
Right.
And I always tell, I mean, the fun was that, and former English teacher here. So do you use I or me? He is better at it than I, or is he better at it than me?
He is better than I am at it. And again, some things like that, it will depend on the context. Are you using a quote? Is it a nonfiction or fiction? Is someone saying it?
Mm-hmm.
And again, talking about dialogue, right?
Yeah.
You want your dialogue to be natural.
Right.
You don't want your characters all to sound like 10th grade English teachers.
The two of us right now, right? We're all so proper.
I break rules.
Yes.
I think it's okay to break rules.
Well, and that's what I would tell my students to say that.
Know them. But they change, right?
Mm-hmm.
The human language has evolved and grammar rules have evolved.
Mm-hmm. And when my students would catch me on something and say, but I am allowed because I am the teacher.
Right, right.
And I can coin words.
Right, right. I'm trying hard to eliminate commas. I think we over-commify our writing sometimes. I think if you can write something without a comma and not cause confusion.
Right.
I think that's
okay.
I'm with you. And again, it has to do with the speed of the story and how much you want your reader to,
right.
To get into it. Or is it a fast passage? Is it slow? Do you want them to slow down?
Right.
Do you have to put that comma before the and?
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. And sometimes, like the rule in a compound or in a, it's a simple sentence, but you have a single subject and a compound verb.
Now you're losing your audience.
Okay. The audience is listening right now. Their eyes are glazing.
They're
up.
Like, no, okay. Don't give me an English lesson right now.
Okay, but the point is that because technically you do not put a comma after the first. So, but if you have a long phrase that comes after the first verb before you get to the second verb,
right.
Sometimes it's helpful that you just need that pause.
Or sometimes you just need to rewrite that long
sentence. Or put a period
in.
And
so. Exactly. Exactly. I've gone back. And again, this is where you have input from your readers.
Right.
If you're losing your readers, if your readers are confused on a certain passage, you need to rewrite it.
And it depends, and if you're writing for, like in your work here with Water White, and so your audience is middle level, okay, so they're not children, but they're not sophisticated adults either reading that. But I've read works, too, that in which they are more adult-oriented, maybe like your novel here, The Hair, in which, the individual's mind. He's in a dark place,
mm-hmm.
Not only psychologically, but physically,
yeah.
It might be down in the subway or something,
right.
And, there's rats around, and his mind is traveling. That sentence might be 100 words long.
Yes.
By the time you're done, because you're following his mind, and we don't think in sentences.
Right.
So it depends on the context also.
Yeah, no, you're right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So much fun.
It is. So so you're doing the sequel to Water White.
Yes, and book two is Water White Flux.
Oh, okay.
Everything is in flux in book two. Powers are in flux.
Mm-hmm.
There's the sky god and the water god, and our hero has to find her way back to her people.
Oh, it sounds like you're bringing
and
the magic.
And there's a huge octopus in it. And, oh my goodness, I got the inspiration for that while I was paddleboarding on Twin Lakes with my husband. I was paddleboarding, he was kayaking. And I got tired after a certain point. And I lay down on my paddleboard and I clipped it to the back of his kayak. And I had my ear to it. And the sound of his paddles in the water sounded like a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that got me thinking about something in the water with a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I thought octopus, but there just had to be an octopus in there. And there's some kind of lair in there, and I won't say any more. It's very exciting, though.
Well, I'm going to give you a writing prompt in the end here, because we think of what we call it prehensile, that you have five toes. There's some people who have six toes, right?
Right.
Okay, so think of an octopus. It's a ninopus, so has a novopus or a nonopus.
Okay,
in other words, has a prehensile.
Yeah.
Has nine tentacles. Oh. Because the studies are finding that the octopuses are very intelligent.
Yes, incredibly.
Creature.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
So get into the head of an octopus that has an extra tentacle that is being ostracized by the
other eight?
Uh-huh. What did I say? Ostrich. Oyster.
Ostrich.
Oyster. Oyster.
Octopus.
As I'm babbling out here, I think it's a better time to cut this off here. But the octopus who has the extra tentacle.
Because evidently, the octopuses, and it's not octopi from what I've learned, it's octopuses. Each of the legs has its own brain.
And oh, really?
They can be chopped off, and they can continue whatever activity they were working on. Octopuses have three hearts, which is pretty fascinating, and that plays into my story.
Oh,
some crazy things that I learned. Octopuses also have copper blood, which when I found out gave me goosebumps because of finding Kumogwe, the water god, who was the copper maker. Oh, my goodness. Everything just
Although I am going to have to look up, because I'm somewhat of a Latin scholar, is that it's
octopi. You think it's octopi? I don't know. I don't know.
But,
I'm going to tell you it's octopuses.
Okay. And I'll say octopi. As we occupy our time here, and we wrap it up. This has been wonderful, Laurel. People want to get your work. Your website.
I'm on Amazon, okay. Laurel McCarg. I have an Amazon.
Spell your last name.
McCharge. Looks like McCargue, but it's McCarg, like an Irish pirate, McCarg, as I would tell my students. And my website is leadvillelaurel.com.
Wonderful. And you're going to head back up to the rarefied air?
I am, and continue work on Waterwhite Flux, because I have several young readers who are clamoring to get it.
Right. Oh, my God.
My goal is to have it by, I'm going to say this, by Halloween.
Wow. Oh, you will be.
I got a bit of work to do.
Yeah, well, you got Labor Day weekend next week.
I know.
Husband, out of town.
Out of town.
Take a trip.
He's out of town again.
Okay, all right. And so our Rangers walk, so we'll be short and quick. So Rangers, here's a woof out to you once again.
Thank you.
Oh, this has been fun stuff.
Thank you, Jerry.
But thanks for coming in. And I want to remind our listening audience, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LP FM 102.7, 103.9. This has been The Rabbit Hole and Writer's Talk. And Laurel McCarg, also known as Leadville Laura, and Laurel. And just had, there's a lot of L's in there, by the way.
Well, alliteration.
La, la,
yes.
La, 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 la,
it had to be Leadville Laurel.
There we go.
Alliteration.
Exactly. We're going to la la go here. There's a week with the la la land. So thanks for tuning in. I will be back in 2 weeks, and we'll pick up more with the rabbit hole then. But in the meantime, let's be safe, be kind, be, you know, just be human to each other.
Thanks, okay? Jerry. Love it.
You got it. Okay. And we'll be back. Okay. Take care now. Bye.
Bye.